Well, when last we met, we found that the greatest patriarch, Abraham, had moved from Hebron down into the upper reaches of the Sinai Peninsula. And though the scriptures don't say so, the reason for the move was an obvious one, which we would not question if we were shepherds of flocks, and that is the need for new grazing land and possibly new water sources. But we also know that it was by the guidance of God's own hand that Abraham decided to make this move. He moves to an area that amazingly has been at the forefront of the evening news for years, and doubly so in recent times since Israel unwisely gave it up to their enemy. And I'm talking about the Gaza Strip. The city of Gerar is on the eastern edge of this area. It is an area that at one time was ruled by the biblical king Abimelech. The king was almost certainly an early Philistine settler. The Gaza Strip makes up a goodly portion of what was, in biblical days, Philistia, the nation of the Philistines. The Philistines are probably Israel's most consistent and noteworthy enemies in all of Bible history, with Amalek being the most dangerous and the most worthy of extinction, according to Jehovah. See, it's amazing to see that the first encounter with a Philistine in the Bible, or at least the people from which came the Philistines, although peaceful, occurred nearly 4,000 years ago. And that Israel's arch enemy today is also the Philistines. How so? Because those people we see attacking Israel at every opportunity, seeking to ultimately destroy her, we call Palestinians, and Palestinian is just the Greek word for Philistine. Now, let's reread chapter 20. We didn't get very of Genesis. We didn't get very far into it last time. So turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 20. It's a short chapter. We find it on page 19 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Genesis chapter 20. Abraham traveled from there towards the Negev, and he lived between Kadesh and Shur. And while living as an alien in Gerar, Abraham was saying of Sarah, his wife, "She's my sister." So Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, "You are about to die because of the woman you've taken, since she's someone else's wife." Now, Abimelech had not come near her, so he said, "Lord, will you kill even an upright nation? Didn't he himself say to me, 'She's my sister'? And even she herself said, 'He's my brother.' In doing this, my heart has been pure and my hands innocent." And God said to him in a dream, "Yes, I know that in doing this your heart has been pure, and I too have kept you from sinning against me. This is why I didn't let you touch her. Therefore, return the man's wife to him now. He is a prophet. He will pray for you so that you will live. But if you don't return her, know that you will certainly die, you and all who belongs to you." And Abimelech got up early in the morning and called all his servants and told them of these things, and the men became very afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? How have I sinned against you to cause you to bring on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done things to me that just aren't done." And Abimelech went on asking Abraham, "Whatever could have caused you to do such a thing?" And Abraham replied, "It was because I thought they could not possibly be in any fear of God in this place, so they will kill me in order to get my wife. But she actually is also my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and so she became my wife. When God had me leave my father's house, I told her, 'Do me this favor, wherever we go, say about me, he's my brother.'" Abimelech took sheep, cattle, male and female slaves, and gave them to Abraham, and he returned him Sarah, his wife. Then Abimelech said, "Look, my country lies before you. Live where you like." To Sarah, he said, "Here, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. That will allay the suspicions of everyone who is with you. Before everyone, you are cleared. Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and slave girls so that they could have children. For Adonai had made every woman in Abimelech's household infertile on account of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Well, we find Abraham is up to his old tricks. Now that he is in a place that he has some trepidation about, he's once again referring to his wife Sarah as his sister. And as far as Abraham is concerned, why not? In Egypt, he came out smelling like a rose. When the Pharaoh took Sarah, he gave her back along with the king's ransom just to stop the plagues that God was visiting on Egypt. Well, now he encounters a king the Bible calls Abimelech, and essentially the Egypt affair happens all over again. Now, for the record, Abimelech is a fairly common name for that era, so it's kind of a combination title and a name. And it means my father is king. Abba, father, Melech, king. And also, just for the record, we will find another Abimelech in the Bible during the time of the Israelites in Canaan a few hundred years into the future. So, don't let it confuse you. It's not that much different than running into a couple of different John Joneses over a long period of time. And that doesn't usually confuse us. Well, it's deja vu all over again. Abimelech takes Sarah. Sarah is 90 years old at this time. What in the world was this king thinking? I mean, the rabbis deduced that she must have been extremely beautiful. She retained all that beauty that had attracted the Pharaoh in Egypt many years earlier, and I suppose that's possible. More likely, though, was that this king was trying to make an alliance with Abraham in the customary way of that era. Marry a family member of a hoped-for ally. Now, it's obvious from the story that there was mutual respect, there were peaceful intentions, and not a case of kidnapping that was going on here. There is no indication of force or bad intent. We now get this interesting little dialogue between Abimelech and God, and God comes right to the point. Abimelech, I'm going to kill you because you have taken a married woman. And Abimelech argues in his defense. He's not had any sexual relations with Sarah. Besides, he had no idea she was a married woman. God acknowledges that Abimelech was telling the truth, but then goes on to say that it was divine power that kept Abimelech from touching Sarah, because if he had, then no excuse would have sufficed. No atonement would have been possible. Death, that would have been the penalty. God orders Abimelech to give Sarah back, that Abraham will intercede for him, and if he did that, he'd live. If not, that was the end of Abimelech's line. Now, did Abimelech know to whom he was talking? First, this encounter was in a dream. A dream was a standard way of communicating with God in that era, and we're told that in the last days, it will once again become a tool for humans to interface with God. Now, perhaps we should not so easily slide right by this common communication channel of a dream between man and God. It is interesting that Abimelech was, by every discernible means, a pagan. And yet, God communicated with him. This will not be the last time we see this happening. Often it is implied among pastors, Bible teachers, if not outright stated, that the Lord God Almighty only communicates with his people. Well, the Bible simply doesn't support that teaching. God is sovereign. He's all-powerful. And yet, while God does not often move a man against his own will, he will do so if it serves his divine purposes. Jehovah has absolute control over all things, humans included. It doesn't matter whether that human's a believer an adherent to a false god or non-god, even an atheist. What's also interesting is how readily Abimelech accepted this instruction of a god. He didn't seem to know. Now, perhaps if there's anything more personally disastrous than a person who places his or her faith in a false god, it is one who acknowledges there's no god whatsoever. Abimelech, although a pagan, had no problem dealing with the spiritual world or with a power higher than himself. A person who's convinced that nothing is higher than himself, that there is no spiritual or supernatural realm, is almost entirely closed to God by definition. I also want to point out that the world and history knows nothing of an ancient society or tribe of any era which did not believe in spirit beings and in a higher authority, a god of one ilk or another. It was not until that era dubbed the Enlightenment of the 1700s AD, and an oxymoron if I've ever heard one, that man had finally reached a point of depravity and of intellectual arrogance as to declare himself the highest of all possible beings of any kind in the cosmos. And of course, the popular thing today is, well, maybe there's aliens, and maybe those aliens are higher than us, but God, no way. The Enlightenment was the birth of atheism and of secular humanism. Second point, whereas more than 99% of the time in the Old Testament, we will find the word, the English word Lord, in our Bibles, where in the original it was actually God's personal name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh-Yehovah. Here we find the word Adonai in the original, because Adonai means Lord. So Abimelech was well aware he was talking to a god. He didn't know which one, so he didn't know this god's name, except that he was the protector god of Abraham. We also find that God invokes Abraham as an intercessor, an intermediary between God and Abimelech. The idea was that the innocent Abraham would plead on the guilty Abimelech's behalf, and since Abraham was a righteous man, then God would listen. This is not the first time Jehovah has positioned Abraham as a righteous mediator between he and mankind. Abraham pled for the few hypothetical righteous people who lived in the city of Sodom before God obliterated it. In actuality, Abraham was interceding for his nephew Lot. And we have in these actions a type and a pattern of Moses being developed for us, and later yet, of course, of Messiah. Now, as we get into verse 8, we find that Abimelech is a tad put off here. Abraham's reticence to be fully truthful has nearly cost Abimelech his life. And Abraham whines that, well, in a certain sense, Sarah really is my sister. Of course, it's also true she's my wife. But I was afraid of you, and I figured out this was the best solution, but I'm really sorry about that. And we get another little tidbit of information that Sarah and Abraham had the same father but different mothers. It is fascinating that unlike Abraham's situation down in Egypt, Abimelech did not kick Abraham out of his country. Rather, he simply added further wealth to Abraham's clan and asked him to stay. We also find at the end of this chapter that God restored Abimelech and his household. In this context, it means that for some unspecified amount of time, none of Abimelech's wives or concubines produced any children for him. So this story we just read in a few verses probably played out over a several month period of time at the least. Not an unusual characteristic for a Bible story that a couple of verses could cover a long period of time. Now, we're going to get into Genesis chapter 1. But before we read that chapter, I want you to know that a quarter of a century has passed since the first few verses of Genesis 12. This was back when Jehovah made a list of promises to Abraham, among which was the promise that from his descendants all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Naturally, the implication was the birth of children to Abraham. But until now, not one child had been born to Abraham's wife, Sarah. Yes, he had a qualified heir, a son, Ishmael, who had been born to Sarah's handmaiden, Hagar. But the Lord God never takes halfway measures. Let's read Genesis chapter 21 all. Open your Bibles again to page 19. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, we're going to read Genesis chapter 21. It is a little longer than the previous one. Genesis chapter 21. Adonai remembered Sarah, as he had said, and Adonai did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah conceived, and she bore Avraham a son in his old age at the very time God had said to him. Avraham called his son born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Yitzhak. Avraham circumcised his son Yitzhak when he was 8 days old, as God had ordered him to do. Avraham was 100 years old when his son Yitzhak was born to him. Sarah said, God has given me a good reason to laugh. Now everyone who hears about it will laugh with me. And she said, who would have said to Avraham that Sarah would nurse children? Nevertheless, I have borne him a son in his old age. The child grew and was weaned, and Avraham gave a great banquet on the day that Yitzhak was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom Hagar had borne to Avraham, making fun of Yitzhak. So Sarah said to Avraham, throw this slave girl out and her son. I'll not have this slave girl's son as your heir along with my son Yitzhak. Avraham became very distressed over this matter of his son. But God said to Avraham, don't be distressed because of the boy and your slave girl. Listen to everything Sarah says to you, because it is your descendants through Yitzhak who will be counted. But I will also make a nation from the son of the slave girl, since he is descended from you. Avraham got up early in the morning. He took bread and a skin of water and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder and the child, and then he sent her away. And after leaving, she wandered in the desert around Beersheba. And when the water in the skin was gone, she left the child under a bush and went and sat down, looking the other way, about a bow shot's distance from him, because she said, I can't bear to watch my child die. So she sat there, looking the other way, crying out, weeping. God heard the boy's voice. And the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what's wrong with you, Hagar? Don't be afraid, because God has heard the voice of the boy in his present situation. Get up, lift the boy up, hold him tightly in your hand, because I'm going to make him a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy water to drink. God was with the boy, and he grew. He lived in the desert. He became an archer. He lived in the Paran desert, and his mother chose a wife for him from the land of Egypt. At that time, Abimelech and Pichol, the commander of his army, spoke to Avraham. They said, God is with you in everything you do. Therefore, swear to me here by God that you will never deal falsely with me or with my son or grandson, but according to the kindness with which I've treated you, you will treat me and the land in which you've lived as a foreigner. And Avraham said, I swear it. Now Avraham had complained to Abimelech about a well which Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech answered, I don't know who has done this. You didn't tell me, and I heard about it only today. Avraham took sheep and cattle and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant. Avraham put 7 female lambs from the flock by themselves. Abimelech asked Abraham, what is the meaning of these seven female lambs you have put by themselves? And he answered, you are to accept these seven female lambs from me as a witness that I dug this well. This is why that place was called Beer Sheva, well of seven, because they both swore an oath there. When they made the covenant at Beer Sheva, Abimelech departed with Pichol, the commander of his army, and returned to the land of the Philistine, the Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beer Sheva, and there he called on the name of Adonai, the everlasting God. Abraham lived there for a long time as a foreigner in the land of the Philistines. This list of prophetic promises of God to Abraham compels me to relate to you something that the Lord has revealed to me over the years. As concerns the understanding of God's people about his prophecies, the mistakes humans make are not that we cannot find a way to relate the eventual fulfillment to the original prophetic pronouncement. The mistake is we do not take God's prophecies literally enough. All of Jehovah's promises to Abraham were literal, and they were all literally fulfilled. Abraham would have a son, not a kind of a son, not a good enough heir that plays with the edges of the law, but a true son, a true heir, regardless of what the earthly human circumstances might seem to dictate as even possible. And because of the times in which we live, I want to say this again. All of God's prophecies should be taken in the most literal possible way. Things may be looking pretty dark for Israel right now, but we can be assured that although the whole world community of nations continues to line up against them, even if Israel finally tells the USA government that they can't stand much more of our supposed help and friendship, the Jewish people will not be expelled from the land. Rather, the prophecies tell us that once they return, after Egypt, after Syria, after Babylon, and then after the Romans had taken their land from them, once they return, which they have, they'll not be leaving. It doesn't matter how reckless, it doesn't matter how ungrateful they are to the one who brought them home. This is a promise from Jehovah God. It's a one-way deal, a promise. We can count on it, literally. God kept his promise, as he always does, and Sarai had a child, Yitzhak, Isaac. Isaac means he laughs. And the promise, 25 years in the making, was for a child of destiny, or better, a child of promise. And we're going to examine shortly these eerie parallels between Isaac and Yeshua. Now, it's an axiom that God's timing is as important an element to any prophetic happening as the details, even the purpose of the happening itself. This is why we see the term God's set times, God's appointed times, over and over again throughout the Torah, as we see that term repeated a number of times in Genesis chapter 21. In a few months now, we're going to study God's appointed feasts, all of which have precise appointed times on the Hebrew calendar. Now, probably nobody here would argue that man has authority to affect or alter or certainly to abolish God's divinely appointed times. Yet it is so curious to me that one of the most basic tenets of Christian doctrine is that indeed we have given to our religious leadership the authority and the ability to change or abolish God's appointed times, including the very first one that God declared. The very first appointed time that affected even how our planet and universe was formed and molded, and then how our planet was given the ability to sustain life. We read this beginning in Genesis 2:1. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed and all their hosts. And by the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. Now this, of course, marks the seventh day Sabbath, called in Hebrew the Shabbat, one of God's appointed times. In fact, it is regarded among the Jews as the most important and holy of all of his appointed times. And as we come across these several appointed or fixed times, we're going to find something they all have in common. They have been designated by Jehovah God as sanctified, meaning holy, set apart. We'll also soon begin to understand that it is God and God alone who declares that which is holy. Mankind has no authority to declare anything holy. Just because a date or an event or a place or an activity or a human being seems to be unusually significant, importance or relevance in our human eyes counts for exactly nothing as to what is holy and what is not. For it is by God's declaration that we who trust his Son have become holy to him. And it's that same way with anything. We only have to discover what the Holy Scriptures appointed times are and then to observe them. We have no authority to change them, abolish them, substitute for them, or even create new ones. So at the time set by God, Isaac is born to Sarah and has been instructed. Abraham circumcised Isaac on the eighth day after his birth. Well, the elderly couple was, of course, overjoyed. Abraham had just turned 100, Sarah 90, when Isaac was produced. It was miracle enough that Abraham could sire a son at that age, or that Sarah, who had never, even as a younger girl, had a womb that could produce life, they could do so several decades after it was humanly possible. But it was also a miracle that such an aged woman could even survive the birthing process. And as verses 6 and 7 show, they were as astonished and dumbfounded as the hundreds and hundreds of people that now formed their clan would have been as well. And in verse 8, we see that when Isaac was weaned, probably somewhere 3 years, 4 years old, maybe a little more, there was great celebration, but trouble was brewing. Ishmael, still the much loved son of Abraham, was now about 15 or 16 years old. And he was apparently constantly taunting this toddler, Isaac. Now, no doubt, Hagar was also giving Sarah a hard time, as well as she felt the effect of her now diminished standing in the family, which began with the birth of Isaac. So, Sarah insists to Abraham that Hagar and Ishmael be banished from the clan. To say that Abraham was troubled would be quite an understatement. Actually, Sarah was simply carrying out God's will. For God told Abraham to do it. Don't be concerned for the boy's welfare. God would bless Ishmael. He would keep him safe. And besides, God says, Isaac, not Ishmael, is the one who will inherit the covenant promises from Abraham. Here we have another and a long line of divisions, elections, separations of God. Ishmael and Isaac are separated. Isaac is sanctified, Ishmael is not. Now, just to add a little context to the situation, there was a good reason that God promised Abraham that Ishmael would be divinely blessed and divinely prospered. Law codes of this era and this area have been discovered. And the exact case we have here is actually discussed in some of those records. Known as the law of Lepit-Ishtar, here's how it works. Abraham had the right to accept or deny Ishmael as an heir to his estate because Ishmael was born to a slave woman. It's obvious by all accounts that Ishmael had been accepted by Abraham as the heir apparent of the clan. Therefore, Ishmael was to have been given the firstborn's share of Abraham's now very substantial wealth. And by this, Hagar, Ishmael's mother, of course, would have benefited. However, because Hagar was a slave, the slave's owner had at all times the right to grant freedom to a slave. The slave, Hagar, belonged legally to Sarah. When Sarah went to Abraham and told him to cast out Hagar and that son of hers, Ishmael, it was Sarah's legal right to do so. However, when a slave woman was released, it was the choice of the father of her children if those children could be released right along with her. Sarah could not legally order Ishmael out, but she could banish his mother, Hagar. Abraham's decision to order Hagar out was not his to make, but his decision to follow Sarah's desire for Ishmael to leave most definitely was up to Abraham. And when he agreed to do as Sarah asked, Ishmael's inheritance went down the drain. Ishmael and Hagar, in a moment, went from being wealthy, having status, having authority, to being penniless and homeless. This was not some vague legal situation that caught Abraham or any of the other players by surprise. The entire scenario we just read here is based on their understanding of this traditional law. Therefore, to soothe Abraham, by his grace, God promised to supply the earthly portion of the blessing that had just been taken away from Ishmael. Therefore, we find that just as Isaac is going to produce 12 grandsons, 12 princes, called the 12 tribes of Israel, so Ishmael will also be blessed with an equal amount of tribal princes and much wealth. Ishmael received by God's provision every bit as much material wealth, perhaps even more, than Isaac. But the one thing Ishmael could not have was the blessing of God to be the promised son, the heir to the covenant promise, was given to Isaac. Abraham obeys Jehovah. He sends Hagar and Ishmael away. I mean, how this must have hurt Abraham. He loved Ishmael. He had counted on Ishmael as his only begotten son for at least 13 years. I don't know how he did it. Well, on the verge of dying of thirst, we are told in verse 17, that Malach Elohim calls out to Hagar. Literally, Malach Elohim means the messenger of God. In this case, this was either an angelic messenger or was a form of God himself. Notice now that this messenger didn't appear before Hagar. He simply called out to Hagar from up in heaven. There is nothing that speaks of an appearance. Also notice, we are told, God heard the cry of the boy, not the cry of a mother. And then the messenger of God says that God has heard the boy. And the next verse says, I'll make a great nation of him. As with the three visitors who came to Abraham a couple of chapters ago, this encounter is very mysterious. Was this an angel or was this God? Now, angels usually make it clear that they are doing the bidding of God.
Here, however, the messenger says, I will make Ishmael a great nation. I don't know for sure the answer to this mystery. My opinion is, this was indeed a manifestation of God. It was not an ordinary angel, but in what form is difficult to ascertain. Hagar opens her eyes, swollen with dust, sand, and tears, and she sees a water well that has miraculously appeared, and mother and son are saved. A promise is made from God that Ishmael will father a great nation. This is really a reminder of a previous commitment to Ishmael, undoubtedly for Hagar's sake. But notice, there is no promise of land, just a nation. And to be clear, in Bible terms, nations are not necessarily about land or even territory. They can designate people groups. Now, after the dramatic rescue and promise, the narrative skips to Hagar and Ishmael becoming desert dwellers. They lived in the Paran Desert. This is an area roughly between the southern end of the Dead Sea, about halfway down to the Sinai Peninsula, and eastward into an area that would someday be known as Midian, or more generally, the Arabian Peninsula. Of course, this is the area that would soon become the root of the Arab nations. But the people who lived in Paran would become what we now call Bedouins, who are an Arab people. Now, I don't want to move into the next phase of chapter 21 until we draw some undeniable and obviously intended parallels between Isaac, the son of the promise, and Messiah, the ultimate son of the promise. Here's just a few more things to consider. There was a very lengthy time between the promise of Isaac and his birth. Same thing for Messiah. The births of Isaac and Yeshua were both miraculous. Isaac's because of his mother's age and dead womb. Yeshua's because Mary was a virgin. Isaac's name was decided by God before he was born. So was Yeshua's. God set a precise appointed time for Isaac's birth, just as he did for Jesus. There's others we're going to shortly come to. Well, at this point, the chapter shifts back now to Abraham's relationship with that Philistine king, Abimelech. And in verse 20, you see Abraham as living in Abimelech's territory, which had been offered to Abraham some years earlier. We see a little more determined, a little stronger Abraham now. From this point forward, apparently with the birth of Isaac, Abraham is now more confident in the ability of the Lord to protect him, to keep his promises to him. And he's more satisfied that if something befalls him and he should now die, he has that all-important heir in Isaac so that the family will move forward with the promises and blessings of God. There was a dispute going on between Abraham's plan and Abimelech's people over some water wells. And the wise Abimelech, aware that Abraham had a friend in the highest place, simply wanted to settle the issue before God threatened him. Again, the negotiations end successfully for the traditional berit, a covenant-making ceremony. And Abimelech and his military commander, who came along with him, went back home now to Gerar. Then we're told that Abraham stayed in that area for a long time. Now, interestingly, the area Abraham returned to is here referred to as the land of the Philistines. Now, whether there were very many Philistines settled yet, and whether or not they even were called Philistines yet, is a matter of some argument, and we'll talk about that in our story next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.